Let's open our Bibles to the fourth chapter of Joshua. Joshua, the fourth chapter. The Jordan River has been stopped. The waters were piled back in a heap, as we saw last week. The people have crossed, and they have all gone over to the other side. You know, it never ceases to amaze me that how many purported Christians. I mean, you'll pick up a commentary or just maybe read something where this story is addressed, or maybe I'll hear something in passing on some sort of broadcast or something. And it never ceases to amaze me the number of purported Christians who will oftentimes go at great lengths of trying to find some sort of rational explanation for these sort of things. You know, somehow they have to fit it into some sort of a naturalistic or scientific kind of a grid. And I agree with Jeffrey Peters as he says regarding this: for God to close off the Jordan is no less trouble than for us to turn off a tap. I mean, if He made the Jordan, if He made the water that goes in the Jordan, if He made the earth, if He is the Creator, what's the big deal? And people who purport to believe in God have a hard time seeing that He can make miracles, and I don't get that. It says in verse 1, it came to pass when all the people had completely crossed over the Jordan. In this verse and a couple other places in the same passage, the King James puts it this way. It says, when all the people were clean passed over the Jordan. I mean, I like it. You know, they clean got over on the other side. That the Lord spoke to Joshua saying, take for yourselves 12 men from the people, one man from every tribe, and command them, saying, take for yourselves 12 stones from here, out of the midst of the Jordan, from the place where the priest's feet stood firm. And you shall carry them over with you, and leave them in the lodging place where you lodge tonight. And so Joshua called the 12 men, whom he had appointed from the children of Israel, one man from every tribe. You know, he did this last week in chapter 3. And he said to them, cross over before the ark of the Lord your God in the midst of the Jordan. Each one of you take up a stone on his shoulder, according to the number of the tribes of the children of Israel, that this may be a sign among you when your children ask in time to come, saying, what do these stones mean to you? Then you shall answer them that the waters of the Jordan were cut off before the ark of the covenant of the Lord when it crossed over the Jordan. And the waters of the Jordan were cut off, and these stones shall be a memorial to the children of Israel forever. You know, memorials are a good thing. They help us remember. And we see several times, especially in the Old Testament, where either the Lord instructed them or in some cases the people took it upon themselves to construct some kind of memorial. And they're good things, you know. I mean, even still, it's been, almost 18 years now, 19 years since the Murrah bombing, and yet you can still go down to the memorial and people will be there, not even going inside to the place, but just looking at the fence, and you'll see people cry. It brings tears. It's a very moving time, you know. It gets me every time I go down there, and it's because it causes me to remember. It takes me back, and I can remember what happened there. And memorials can be a good thing. And it says that I want you to do this so that in the time to come, when your children say, "What's up with this?" you'll have an explanation for them. You know, the children need to be taught. That's all there is to it. I mean, it just simply said that the children need to be taught. If not, they're going to be lost. You know, I've heard sometimes parents will have the philosophy, well, I don't want to force my children what to believe. I'm going to let them make their own choice in what to believe about God and that sort of thing. And, you know, that's okay. It's just against the Bible. It's just that's not God's will. That's something that's very contrary to God's will. He tells us over and over again that we are to train our children up in the way that they are to go. And if not, they're going to be lost. By the way, there seems to be this phase in every child development. You know, first of all, when they become self-aware, when they realize who they are, the very first word they learn is mine, right? And then, you know, you're going to throw in all the other ones where they say, I love mama and I love dad. You know, yeah, okay. But then the next word they learn is why. They want to know why. They want to know why about this and why about that. And even when you answer their question, they want to know why about your answer. And it's just a steady stream of why. Well, you know what? They're supposed to. I think God wants them to do that. He wants them to ask so that we will tell them, so that we'll teach them and train them. It says, the children of Israel did so, just as Joshua commanded. And they took up the 12 stones from the midst of the Jordan, as the Lord had spoken to Joshua, according to the number of the tribes of the children of Israel, and carried them over with them to the place where they lodged and laid them down there. Each guy picked up a rock and put it on his shoulder. I don't know how big these rocks were, but these guys must have been, pretty beefy. And it says he set up 12 stones in the midst of the Jordan, this is verse 9, in the place where the feet of the priests who bore the Ark of the Covenant stood, and there they are to this day. Now, this verse 9 kind of just is inserted in here, and we think, well, this doesn't seem to fit. What does this mean? God had told him to take stones out of the Jordan and then make a memorial, make a pillar, make a pile of rocks on the western side of the river. But here Joshua says that he took 12 men to take rocks from the western side of the river and take them into the river. The NIV tries to fix this confusion by saying Joshua set up the 12 stones that had been in the middle of the Jordan at the spot where the priests had carried the ark where the covenant stood. And the NIV tries to make this just one event. That's not what the text says, though. That's not a good translation. There are two events here. First of all, has them pick up stones out of the bedrock, out of the riverbed, and go over to the other side. And then when they're there, they take 12 other stones and take them back into the middle of the river. That's what the text says. What's the purpose? Why would he have him take rocks into the middle of the river, and then in just a minute we're going to see where God turns the tap back on and the water flows back in and those rocks disappear and nobody ever, God's the only one knows they're there. And I guess our author, because he says they're still there. What would be the purpose of this second memorial? Well, on one hand, it could be, I read this illustration one time where there's this river in Geneva, and there's a rock, a fairly good-sized rock in the river, and it's below, whenever the water gets down very low, like during a time of drought or something, and the water level dips down quite a bit, this rock becomes exposed. And at some point in times past, somebody went out in the river where this rock was, and they etched into it, "If you can read this, weep." And, their point is that if the water level ever gets down that low to where this rock is exposed and you can read what's written on the rock, then you're in trouble because you're in the middle of a big drought. That's the whole idea of the inscription. And it could be that what Joshua was doing here is if the water level ever did get down, they would have periods of drought in Israel, and if the water level ever did get down to where those rocks would be exposed, that it would be a memorial to them that God would be faithful even during a time of drought. God has given us memorials, and some of the commentators, that there's we can look at these two memorials. You got this one where there's rocks on the west side of the Jordan, and then there's this other one where there's rocks in the middle of the Jordan, and there's some different things that we can take from that as to what is our lesson from this. What is the typology here going to speak to? Some could see it as, and I've read some commentators that will say, well, the Lord has given us two memorials. In the church, we have two sacraments, if you will. There have been two commemorative observances that the Lord has given us, two rites, if I could use that word. There's the rite of baptism and the Lord's table. And they both have two different meanings, but they also have two different expressions, where baptism, water baptism, is a very public thing. It's an outward expression of an inward change, right? It's a proclamation to the world that I have decided to follow Jesus. It's very public, and it's for everybody to see. Yet communion, on the other hand, kind of a homeboy thing, right? I mean, it's for the believers. It's something that you do in the service, and it's intended for believers to proclaim Christ's death until he comes. In fact, in the early years of the church, when they would hear the rumors of what would take place during the Lord's Supper, where they would actually partake of the body and the blood of the Lord, that there was some of the criticisms because they didn't go to the meetings. They were on the outside, and they didn't know. And so some of the critics were saying that they were actually involving themselves in cannibalism just because they didn't understand the meaning of this very private, very sacred rite that was part of the church. And so here you've got these two memorials where you've got one that's very public, it's very shown, it's very out there. Every time some kid walks by, says, "Daddy, how come that pile of rocks is there?" Then the kid can show him. The other one is hidden. It's something that you only know it's there if you know it's there. And it's something that would be only for the believers. That's possible. That could be part of it. You know, the Lord has given us His Lord's Supper as a memorial. And one of the things about memorials, I mean, at some point, I like going to, if you're ever in Honolulu, for example, you want to go see the Alabama and just all of the, I mean, those things can be very moving, very stirring kind of encounters. And memorials can be a good thing. Sometimes, though, they can become kind of routine and become so commonplace that they kind of lose their punch. You know, if you were to go down to the National Memorial every day, after a while, you know, maybe it wouldn't have quite that same significance to you that it would have if you just went once in a while. And I've spent probably, well, not probably, most of my life has been in some sort of a church setting or another. You know, from going to Sunday school as a kid to, you know, my involvement as an adult and then even becoming a Christian when I was 30. And I've been in virtually every size and shape and configuration of church service you can imagine. And I've been under every sort of approach to, let's say, the Lord's Supper that someone could have. From a very casual kind of, you know, well, we'll do it maybe once a year if we think about it, to the idea that you very legalistically and religiously have to do it every week. And I found in both extremes that it can become this very casual kind of rote, sort of go through the motions where you mouth the words and it kind of loses its meaning, loses its punch. And yet it's a memorial that the Lord gave us. It's something that he told us to do in remembrance, in a memorial to his work. Does the Lord's Supper, when you come to the Lord's table, is that something that draws you to him, or does it become just a ritual? It says, "The priest who bore the ark stood in the midst of the Jordan until everything was finished that the Lord had commanded Joshua to speak to the people, according to all that Moses had commanded Joshua. And the people hurried and crossed over." I bet they did, you know. I mean, we got somewhere in the neighborhood of 2+ million people getting across this riverbank. And during flood stage, it could be as much as 0.5 mile wide in this area. At that time. So, I mean, this was a very major sort of a thing. And it wasn't something that just took place in a couple of minutes. I mean, it would take several hours for everybody to get across. But then as we're noticing, the priests lead the way, and then they kind of like set up this station there with the Ark of the Covenant, and everybody goes across, and then the priests are still there. They've been in there this whole time, you know. But when the people got in, they went across, and it says, "It came to pass when all the people had completely crossed over that the Ark of the Covenant and the priest crossed over in the presence of the people. And the men of Reuben, the men of Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh crossed over armed before the children of Israel, as Moses had spoken to them." Remember, there were those 2.5 tribes that wanted to stay on the Transjordan side. They wanted to stay in the area of what's today roughly Jordan and part of Syria. They wanted to stay in that area. The pasture land was good. They were cattle guys, and they just thought, this, you know, we don't need to go over to the other side. This is good enough for us. And we've talked about the typology and the symbolism that's involved in that. And so Moses told them, said, God told Moses to tell them, "That's okay. If you want to stay over here, that's fine. If you want to settle for second best, all right. But you got to at least go over and help your posse take the land. You got to go over with your brothers and help them take it." And so when it was time for them to cross over, it says that they had the men who were armed before and they went over. It says about 40,000 prepared for war crossed over before the Lord for battle to the plains of Jericho. Now in Numbers chapter 26, where it's kind of giving the number of the people, and it says, take the sum of the congregation of the children of Israel from 20 years old and upward. Throughout their father's house, all that are able to go to war in Israel. So Numbers 26 is a numbering of the children of Israel, of everybody that was able to be part of the army. Okay? Everybody that was, when you were 20 years old, you became, until, you know, presumably whatever, old like me, you, in between that time, you had to be in the army. And so he says, take a number of all of those people. And of the 2.5 tribes, of the tribe of Reuben, they counted, number 7, there was 43,730. Okay? And then in the tribe of Gad, they counted 40,500. Now, in the tribe of Manasseh, there was 52,700, but if we figure it was only half of the tribe over there, we can divide that in half, roughly speaking. That would give us 26,350. And you add those three together, and that gives 110,580 guys suitable for battle. Less than half of them crossed over to go to war. Now, did it require some roughly 60% of them to stay to protect the women and children on the Transjordan side? I don't know the logistics of that. I wouldn't be able to speak to it. But it does seem like a small number when you think of the total number of the three tribes, that only they only had 40,000 that crossed over. And it speaks so clearly, I think it speaks so fully to the overwhelming percentage of Christians, the overwhelming percentage of these 2.5 tribes were satisfied with what they had. They were satisfied. They didn't care for God's promises. They didn't care for God's best. They didn't care to cross over into the land flowing with milk and honey. They weren't, as we have seen the symbolism and the typology of our illustration, they weren't concerned with having the victorious Christian living kind of experience. They were just satisfied with status quo. They were satisfied with being just enough. And it would appear as though this number kind of speaks to that. And it says in verse 14 that on that day, the Lord exalted Joshua in the sight of all Israel. And they feared him as they had feared Moses all the days of his life. And so then the Lord spoke to Joshua. You know, he told him, I'm going to exalt you before the people. In the same way that they looked to Moses as their leader, well, before I'm done, they're going to look to you the same way. And so this is the day that they did that. You know, as in the same way that when the Red Sea parted and the children of Israel crossed over on the dry land at the Red Sea, they said, Moses, you the man. Well, now the Jordan's doing the same thing, and they're recognizing Josiah or Joshua in that same position. And it says, then the Lord, verse 15, spoke to Joshua, saying, command the priests who bear the ark of the testimony to come up from the Jordan. So everybody's got over on the other side. They've carried the 12 rocks back in the middle of the riverbank, riverbed. And then he says, okay, now get the priests to come out. And so he commanded his priests, saying, come up from the Jordan. And it came to pass, when the priests who bore the ark of the covenant of the Lord had come from the midst of the Jordan, and the soles of the priests' feet touched the dry land, that the waters returned to their place and overflowed all its banks as before. Could you imagine what that scene was like? I mean, could you even picture the noise? I mean, it was, as we saw last week, the river had been backed up some 16 or 17 miles upstream. This heap wasn't even in their eyesight. You know, it was, they couldn't even see where that heap of water was. All they saw was that the riverbed went dry, and it wasn't even muddy. But they don't know where the water was. It's up river, 16 miles. And then God released it. From the very second that the last heel left the riverbed, God released it. And all of these hundreds of thousands of millions of gallons of water came crashing down all at once. What a scene. It says, now the people came up from the Jordan on the 10th day of the first month, and they camped at Gilgal on the east border of Jericho. So they're just opposite Jericho. They're on the western side of the river now. They've crossed over, and this place of Gilgal was just located. It's only a couple of miles from the ancient city of Jericho. And it says that they did it on the 10th day of the first month, 10th of Nisan. Anybody know what the significance of the 10th of Nisan would be? First day of Passover. So on the first day of Passover was the day when the people would go into their flocks and they would pick out the lamb that would be without blemish, and it would be the one that they were going to pick to be their sacrificial Passover lamb, and they would bring it into the home. And you know, we've seen all that, seen the stories where they would examine the lamb and spend the next 5 days, 4 days, kind of checking it out. Well, this is the first day. This would be the day of the Passover. And it says, and those 12 stones which they took out of the Jordan, Joshua set up at Gilgal. So not only did they carry them out of the riverbed, but then they went south about 8 miles to where Gilgal is. And so these guys were carrying these big old honking rocks on their shoulders all this way. And he spoke to the children of Israel, saying, when your children ask their fathers in time to come, saying, what are these stones? Then you shall let your children know, saying, Israel crossed over this Jordan on dry land. Now, that brings up another point here that I think cannot be overemphasized. Not only are we instructed to teach our children that is something that is, it's a direct commission from God, but it says here, fathers, teach your children. It's the father's commission. It's the father's job. God has called the fathers to do the teaching. It's not the Sunday school teacher's job. It's certainly not the school teacher's job. It's not even the Christian school teacher's job. It's the father's job to make sure that the children receive the instruction to know about God's faithfulness. And so he says, so when your kids start this whole why thing, you'll have a ready answer for them. You can say, because you see that river right there? During the flood season, God stopped its flow. And we didn't walk over in the mud. We walked over on dry ground. He says, for the Lord your God dried up the waters of the Jordan before you until you had crossed over, as the Lord your God did to the Red Sea, which he dried up before us until we crossed over. And all the peoples of the earth, not just simply the 12 tribes, not even just simply the inhabitants of Canaan, the various ites that we looked at last week, not just simply them, but all the peoples of the earth may know that the hand of the Lord, that it is mighty, and you may fear the Lord your God forever. Now, something I think is somewhat significant, too, is worth noticing. In the end of John chapter 1, we're introduced to John the Baptist. And it says in, I think it's verse 28 of chapter 1, yeah, John 1:28, it says that John was baptizing in this area known as Bethabara. Some of the other translations, some of the other manuscripts say Bethany, but it's a place called Bethabara, which means the house of the ford. Very likely the very same place. We don't know the exact location of the Gilgal in this place of, you know, it's like a 10-mile stretch, but very likely the very same place. And I think it's very significant that this crossing and these memorials were set up at the very identical place where Jesus himself was baptized. Verse 1 of chapter 5 says, so it was when all the kings of the Amorites who were on the west side of the Jordan and all the kings of the Canaanites who were by the sea heard that the Lord had dried up the waters of the Jordan from before the children of Israel until we had crossed over, that their heart melted and there was no spirit in them any longer because of the children of Israel. Now, oftentimes the term we've seen before, the term Amorites, is kind of used as a collective term for all the inhabitants. In this particular case, he's making a distinction. The Canaanites, he's calling those that lived on the western half of Canaan, basically in the area of Philistia and along the coastlands. And then the Amorites were those that lived more closer to the Jordan Valley. And it says, you know, we saw last week when they were talking to Rahab, that she told him, he says, man, our hearts trembled when we heard about what your God did for you at the Red Sea. And, you know, first they trembled at what the Lord did there. Now they're trembling at what he's doing now. Do our enemies today tremble at what the Lord is doing in our lives? You know, I asked myself that question today, and I was thinking, well, probably not. And then the Lord reminded me, well, wait a minute, who are your enemies? If we don't wrestle against flesh and blood, then my true enemies are spiritual in nature. And yeah, when the Lord's doing something in my life, they do tremble. You know, they tremble at the very name of Jesus. So we need to remember, you know, we don't wrestle against flesh and blood, and that when our eyes are on God and we're following His leading, then our enemies will tremble in the same way that Israel's did 3,500 years ago. And it says at that time, the Lord said to Joshua, make flint knives for yourselves and circumcise the sons of Israel again the second time. Now, I don't know what it means by again the second time. There are different views on it. Some believe, and the most common view, and it's probably as good as explanation as any, most common view is that he was talking about when they circumcised in Egypt, when their dads had done the circumcision in Egypt when they left Egypt before the very first Passover. And it would appear as though there hadn't been any circumcising take place while they were in their wilderness wanderings. And so this would be the second time that they were doing it. That's probably what's being met here. So here they are. They've crossed over the river. They've gone down. They're 2 miles away from Jericho. They can see the walls in the distance. And they're encamping for getting ready for battle array. And all the generals are coming together, and the various officers are coming. What's the military strategy? What are we going to do next? And God says, well, here's what you do. I want all of your males to get circumcised. Now, you can imagine, say, Lord, could we talk just a minute about your military strategy here? I mean, I'm not quite sure this is going to be, you know, how about this? Let's go kill all the Jerichoites, then we'll get circumcised. Then we'll take care of that. But this doesn't really seem to be very strategic. And why now? Why at this point is God doing this? Well, what happens with circumcision? You know, the flesh is removed. And as they have crossed over the Jordan, as we've seen the symbolism of leaving Egypt as salvation, crossing the Dead Sea or Red Sea is baptism. The wilderness wanderings is trying to learn how to walk by faith. Crossing the Jordan is the baptism with the Holy Spirit. Entering into the Promised Land is that victorious life, the promised life, the John 10:10 abundant life that comes from being baptized with the Spirit. Unless the flesh is removed, there will be no victory. Period. And so here is they're facing their very first, facing would be facing and fighting at the same time. As they're facing their very first battle with these inhabitants of the land, God is saying, before you do anything, before the next step, we got to get the flesh out of the way. Paul, writing to the Galatians, said in Galatians 5:24, those who are Christ have crucified the flesh with its passions and desires. And it's very easy to understand how we could make that kind of an adaptation, some sort of a correlation between the Old Testament Jewish rite of circumcision and the idea of removing our flesh and being separated from our flesh, crucifying the flesh, as Paul said in Galatians chapter 5. We say, well, that's kind of a New Testament adaptation to an Old Testament concept. That removal of the flesh. It was actually what baptism was just simply a sign of the covenant between the Jews and Jehovah. Well, Deuteronomy 10:16 says, therefore, circumcise the foreskin of your heart and be stiff-necked no longer. It seems like God has something a little more in mind than just simply a sign of the covenant. And it was that. But as he's making this application of the removal of the flesh, we can see that he has the same idea as he says, circumcise the foreskin of your heart. And again, in chapter 30 of Deuteronomy, chapter 30, verse 6, it says, and the Lord your God will circumcise your heart and the heart of your descendants to love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, that you may live. In many ways, even though it was a command of the Lord, even though it was a sign of the covenant, we could say that circumcision was an outward sign of an inward change. Much of what we say of baptism. Colossians chapter 2 draws the parallel between the two. And Jeremiah chapter 4 verse 4 says, circumcise yourselves to the Lord and take away the foreskins of your heart. And so God's telling them, before we can embark on this victory, before we can begin to realize this promise that I've given you, you're going to realize the promise. I gave the promise back in Egypt. You guys are about to receive it. You're going to realize it. Before you do, we've got to get the flesh out of the way. And it says in verse 3, so Joshua made flint knives for himself and circumcised the sons of Israel on the hill of Foreskins. Now, a couple of things about this verse. First of all, some army, they didn't even have any knives. They had to go make knives. You know, here's this army is getting ready to go whoop up on the Jerichoites, and they didn't even have any knives. They had to go make them. And I understand that the western side of the Jordan, you know, in the land of Canaan, it's a very flinty area, and they could make flint knives there that they wouldn't have had in the wilderness. But they didn't have any knives. They had to go make them. And then it says, and so they circumcised him at this place that was called the Hill of the Foreskins. New American and the New International just transliterate it. They call this place Gibeath Haraloth. And I guess they kind of figured calling it the Hill of Foreskins put a damper on the tourist trade. And so they said, well, let's not translate it. Let's just transliterate it. And, you know, probably Chamber of Commerce had something to do with that. So they did this at a place called Gibeath Haraloth. And this is the reason why Joshua circumcised them. And so here we're getting to it. Here's why they did it. All the people who came out of Egypt who were males, all the men of war, had died in the wilderness on the way after they had come out of Egypt. For all the people who came out had been circumcised, but the people born in the wilderness on the way as they came out of Egypt, they hadn't been circumcised. For the children of Israel walked 40 years in the wilderness till all the people who were men of war who came out of Egypt were consumed because they did not obey the voice of the Lord, to whom the Lord swore that he would not show them the land which the Lord had sworn to their father that he gave us, a land flowing with milk and honey. You know, when they first left Egypt, they sent the 12 spies into the land. They came back. We've seen this where they came back with a negative report, and so the people believed them. So God says, well, okay, we'll just... this generation won't go in. We'll just raise up the next one then. And it says in verse 7 that Joshua circumcised their sons whom he had raised up in their place, for they were uncircumcised because they had not been circumcised in the way. And so very first order of business was to take care of this. And it says that, and it was when they had finished circumcising all the people that they stayed in their places in the camp until they were healed. And then the Lord said to Joshua, this day I have rolled away the reproach of Egypt from you. Therefore, the name of this place is called Gilgal, which means rolling, to this day. What does he mean by the reproach of Egypt? Now, I read many commentators that made some comment, something along the lines of, well, you know, when they were in Egypt, they were these slaves, and they were looked down upon, and they were mistreated by the Egyptians and abused, and so this was a reproach, and God was going to remove that reproach from them. Well, he'd done that 40 years earlier when he took them out of Egypt. They were no longer slaves of Egypt anymore. He had already done that for them. He had removed that reproach. So what does he mean by, on this day, I've removed this reproach, the reproach of Egypt from you? And I think what he's talking about is the fact that they could have gone into the promised land earlier. You know, it's only a week and a half journey from the Nile Delta area to the promised land. They could have made it really quickly. Yet because they didn't trust, because they wouldn't believe him, because they disobeyed him, they weren't allowed to go in. And so they had to wander around there in the desert for 40 years. And so here Moses goes up to Pharaoh and he says, God says, let my people go. I'm going to take them to the promised land. And, you know, it took 10 different plagues before Pharaoh finally let them go. And then they didn't go to the promised land. And this had become a reproach, not so much for the people, but a reproach for God, because God said, I'm going to take you there, but you didn't go. And so I think that's the reproach he's talking about, just the idea that he said they were going to go to the promised land, but they hadn't done it because of their rebellion. And so God had to put them on hold for a while. I'll tell a story on Anthony, since he's not in here. When he was real little, probably that age, you know, 2, 3, somewhere in there. And we'd gone over to his house one day, Sherry and I, and Brandy and Sherry went shopping. And so it was me and Anthony and Christian were there at home. And Anthony wanted to go with him. And his mom was saying, no, you stay here with your papa and your dad. And he wasn't liking that solution, and so he started crying. And even after they left, he kept crying. It was just that kind of that whiny sort of toddler kind of, you know, you know, sort of incessant sort of thing. Well, they had at this time, they had in Anthony's bedroom, the chair. You know, this was the chair where you go, this is the timeout chair. This is where you go and think about what you've done, sort of thing. And so after a few minutes of this, Christian told him to go to the chair, you know. So he goes in there, and Christian and I were in the living room. We could hear him all this time. He just kept doing this whole crying thing. Went on for a long time. I mean, many minutes, over a half an hour, upwards 45 minutes. He's still crying. He hasn't let up a bit. So I asked Christian, I said, can I go talk to him? Just see if I can reason with him. He said, yeah, go ahead. So I went back there, and I just said, Anthony, you know, if you could just stop crying, you're in here because you won't stop crying. If you would just stop crying, then we can come out of the living room, we can play, and we can have fun. Well, that just made him cry harder, you know, and he just dug his heels in. You know, I'm going to win this one, you know, and he dug his heels in, and he said, you know, keep crying. So I left. About 10 minutes later, I went back in there again. Same thing. About 10 minutes later, I went back in there again. This goes on for over an hour. We're probably going an hour and 15, hour and 20 minutes finally. So Christian goes back there. He comes back after a few minutes. And then finally, about an hour and a half of Anthony being in there crying, Christian goes in there, and he finally gets him to get it. If I stop crying, I can come out of here. So he stops, and he comes out, and he's all happy now, and he comes up and apologizes to me, and he apologizes to Christian, and he wants to read books. And so he crawled up in my lap, and we started reading books. And after about, you know, 15 or 20 books, he looked over at me, and he says, I'm really sorry I was crying, Papa. And I said, you know, Anthony, here's the thing. We're having a really good time now. And if you had stopped crying a long time ago, we could have been having this really good time a lot longer. You know, we could have started this a long time ago. And it's almost bedtime now. You know, I mean, almost the whole evening was wasted where we could have been having fun reading these books together. That's kind of how it was with the children of Israel. That was their reproach, that they had refused to enter into God's rest, as the writer of the Hebrews says, because they refused to trust God in the situation. And so they had to do things their own way. They had to be in charge, had to be in control. And how many of us as Christians lose God's best? We never experience what he has for us just simply because we got to do it our way. We got to be in control. And so they camped at this place called Gilgal. And that's just what they called it, because this reproach was rolled away on that day. There was no town, there was no village or anything. It was just a camp. But it became kind of a major place in Israel's history from that time forward. A lot of things happened at Gilgal after that. But it's just all of this, if you look here at this map of the area, the place where Bethabara, probably Gilgal and Jericho, these are all like within a stone's throw of each other. You know, they're all very close proximity of one another. And so the Jerichoites are quaking in their sandals, looking over their wall and seeing this encampment with all of these hundreds of thousands, millions of Israelites down by the river. And it says that the children of Israel camped at Gilgal, this is verse 10, and kept Passover on the 14th day of the month at twilight on the plains of Jericho. So they've been there 4 days now. It's 14th, that's the night of Passover. They slay the lamb, they have the big feast, they're having a party, and all the people in Jericho are on their walls just wondering how come, you know, what's going on and what are they going to do. And it says, and they ate the produce of the land on the day after the Passover, unleavened bread and parched grain on that very same day. And then, notice verse 12, then the manna ceased on the day after they had eaten the produce of the land, and the children of Israel no longer had manna, but they ate the food of the land of Canaan that year. You know, they basically lived off of the land of the produce that had been raised by the people that they were driving out under the Lord's command. Now, if I was going to ask the question, when did God's provision for the Israelites stop? Would you say that it would be on this day after Passover? No. His provision never stopped. It just changed. And, you know, the reason why I think this is significant is because, you know, here these guys, the vast majority of them, were born in the wilderness. The vast majority of them had never eaten anything other than manna. I mean, they made manna splits and manicotti and, you know, they did everything they could with it, but it was still manna. And that's all they'd had for 40 years. Wake up every morning, there it was. They'd get it. They'd say, what is it? And then they'd pick it up and then they'd eat it. And that's all they'd had. And it was always there. And every morning it would be there again. And they never had to sweat it. They never had to worry about it. They never had to look anyplace else. They never had to make any decisions. They didn't have to do anything because it was there. God provided it. And I can imagine not ever having known anything else. And, you know, I'm one of these guys. I mean, I'm like the consummate conservative. I don't like change, you know. And to have all of a sudden everything you'd ever known, the only thing you'd ever known, change in such a dramatic way could have been very unsettling for them. And sometimes when we face changes, when God brings us to a point of change, you know, sometimes, I mean, there's nothing wrong with being comfortable, but sometimes God doesn't want us to be comfortable. You know, He wants to kind of shake us up a bit so we can understand more of what it's like to be dependent upon Him and have that daily faith kind of a situation where we are trusting Him for our daily bread. And so He can shake us up. And sometimes that which we had been kind of accustomed to, that which we had become dependent upon, that which we had always thought was a constant and a standard, He takes away because He doesn't want us to rest. He doesn't want us to depend upon the manna. He wants us to depend upon Him. But that didn't mean His provision stops. And they were faced, as we often are, with that very solemn choice of whether they were going to accept that and recognize it and believe it. Verse 13 says, "And it came to pass, when Joshua was by Jericho, that he lifted his eyes and looked, and behold, a man." Notice, if you've got the New King James, it's a capital M. "A man stood opposite him with a sword drawn in his hand, and Joshua went to him, and he said to him, 'You for us or against us? You know, are you on our side or are you on the other guy's side? Are you for us or are you for our adversaries?' And then he said," so this man, this guy that was standing there, said, "No, but as the captain of the army of the Lord, I have now come." You know, he asked him this question. He says, are you for us or are you against us? And so the answer to that would be, I'm on your side or I'm on their side. You know, either he is a Jerichoite that just kind of got lost, or he's one of the Israelites who's just out stretching his legs. But he didn't answer him that. He didn't say that. He just says, "No, I'm captain of the Lord's army." In other words, what he was saying to Joshua is, you're asking the wrong question. The question is not whether or not I'm on your side. The question, Josh, is whether or not you're on my side. You know, this is what's known as what the Bible guys have termed as a theophany, which means the word theophany, and different religions have their own versions of theophany, but in the Christian faith, a theophany is a pre-incarnate manifestation of Jesus. Before his birth, it's when he would appear under the Old Testament pages. Now, sometimes you'll see, in modern days, a lot of guys will say that's also known as a Christophany, but technically, and it's just only the older dictionaries that do this, but technically a Christophany is a post-resurrection appearance of Jesus. And a theophany is a pre-incarnate manifestation of Jesus. But we have these throughout the Old Testament. And several occurrences of theophanies, I just like to mention a few of them. One is, and usually whenever this would happen, he's not in this case, but whenever you have this theophany, he's identified as the angel, the definite article, angel of the Lord. Angel, Malach of Yahweh, the angel of the Lord. And he's usually identified in that very specific form. We have in Genesis 22, there was Joshua when he wrestled with the angel all night long. That was probably the first occurrence of the theophany. Abraham with the, in chapter, 19 when he, right before the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, that would have been the first one. As I said, usually he's called the angel of the Lord. In Genesis 16, we have Hagar and Ishmael when they ran from Abraham and Sarah to get away from him. They went out in the wilderness, and it says, then the angel of the Lord came and ministered to her. And usually in these occurrences, these theophany occurrences, at some point in the passage, he's identified as the Lord. It'll say the angel of the Lord, and then at some other point, he'll be called the Lord. And this right-hand column, verse 13 of Genesis 16, is where he's identified as the Lord there in that passage. In Numbers 22, you got the story about Balaam and his donkey, and the angel of the Lord who's waiting there at the end of the wall, getting ready to whack his head off. And it says in verse 28, he's identified as the Lord himself. In Judges chapter 2, God says that the angel of the Lord went from Gilgal. He'd been hanging out there at Gilgal where their camp was. And then he went to this place called Bochim, which just means weeping. I think it was named because of this. And he said to the people, he said, look, I told you not to get any of that Canaanite stuff on you. And you're being influenced by them. You're not driving them out like I told you to. And you're going to be influenced by their gods and by all their other stuff. So this ain't working. And it says the people repented and they all began weeping. They called the place Bochim. And in verse 1, he says, I led you. The angel of the Lord said, I'm the one that took you out of Egypt and provided for you throughout the wilderness. In Judges chapter 6, Gideon, when he was threshing the wheat in the wine press, trying to hide out from the Midianites, and the angel of the Lord appears to him in verse 14, he's identified as the Lord himself. In Judges chapter 13, we have Samson's parents. He appears to them, and they kind of freak out later. They say, man, we just saw God, and we're going to die. And Mrs. Samson's mom said, if that was happening, we'd already be toast, you know. And so I guess we're okay. And then there's several places in the Kings, books of Kings, and just Samuel, Chronicles, and Kings. We have several occurrences of those. The New King James typically doesn't capitalize the word angel unless someplace in the passage he's identified as the Lord. But I'm of the opinion that anytime you see that phrase, the angel of the Lord, that it is a theophany. Four times in Zechariah, we see this. And then I think probably one of the best known ones that I save for last is in Exodus chapter 3 when Moses saw the bush that wouldn't be consumed, got on fire and wouldn't be consumed. And it says that this actual burning bush was a theophany. Usually he appears as a man. In this case, he was a burning bush. And in verse 4, he's identified as the Lord. And the reason why I said that is because this is just so reminiscent of the story that we see here. Very parallel stories. As this guy, this commander of the Lord's army, says to Joshua, Josh, you need to rephrase your question. Tell me, whose side are you on? And it says Joshua fell on his face to the earth and worshipped him. And said to him, what does my Lord say to his servant? You know, I was reading this one commentary today that said this wasn't the Lord himself, that it was this actual captain of the Lord's army, but no angel would ever receive worship. We see in the book of Revelation, John, the apostle John, who knew the Lord pretty intimately, and he got confused on that subject a couple times. So no angel would ever receive worship, but this guy does. And he says, what would you say to me? You know, we would probably think, and we probably, we all have that, you know, we've got that list of whenever we get before God, we're going to roll out this list of questions that we got for him. And almost every one of those questions have the word why at the beginning of them, right? You know, why did you do this? Why didn't you do this? Why did this happen? Why did you allow that happen? I just, you know, it's kind of like it was with Job, you know, why God, why God, why? Probably when we get in his presence, it's going to be just like it was with Joshua. He didn't say why. He says what. What would you have me do? This is what Paul said, you know, when he had the similar encounter. And so he says, what give, you know, okay, I'm on your side. What do I do? And it says, the captain of the Lord's army said to Joshua, take your sandal off your foot, for the place where you stand is holy. Where else have we heard that phrase? Well, it was in Exodus chapter 3, wasn't it? When Moses was standing before the burning bush, and the first thing that the voice said to him was, take off your shoes, because this is a holy place. You know, and the idea of it was because your feet are touching the world. Your feet are getting contaminated by the world, and this is a holy place. This is a set-apart place. This isn't a place for worldly contamination. Is that kind of idea. And then it says in the last half of verse 15, and Joshua did so. I'll bet. You know, good call, Josh. I mean, that was a good choice. You know, he says, what do you have me do? He said, well, starters, take off your shoes. Okay, yeah. I mean, you just see how quick you could get it done. This was a very, I think, pivotal point for Joshua. Not only was the Lord putting his hand upon him, but before, just as it was for the children of Israel, before they could go into victory, before they could go claim what the Lord had for them, they had to remove the flesh. And before Joshua could lead them, he had to realize that it wasn't him doing the leading. I imagine he was probably very overwhelmed. And anybody that's ever been in any kind of leadership position, you understand this. You know, there is this wet blanket of responsibility that we feel. And we understand it's the Lord. We know it's the Lord, but it's up to me. Somehow I got to tap into Him, and I got to be able to hear His voice so I can tell. You know, people want to know what God's will is, and so I'm the pastor, and so I got to know it, and I got to be able to you know, channel God so I can tell people what God's will. And that feeling of responsibility sometimes can be very overwhelming. And so the Lord is saying to Joshua, "Nah, it doesn't work that way. That's not the way it is. It's not on your shoulders, Josh. You don't have to tap into me. You have to yield to me. You don't have to channel me. You just have to get out of my way. You have to surrender to me." And that's the lesson that he was learning at this point, and one that he learned very well. And next week we'll see how he takes that lesson and leads him on to victory in Jericho. Father, we do bow before you this evening, and we thank you for your blessed sovereignty. God, we thank you that you are so in charge of even the smallest details of our life. God, teach us how to rest in that. Teach us how to be at that place where we don't need to take things into our own hands, that we can just fully and completely surrender it over to you, and then have that blissful rest that comes from unsurpassing, incomprehensible peace. Just as you promised the Israelites back in Deuteronomy, you brought them out so that you could bring them in. And you've done that with us. And God, as we get out of your way and just fully surrender to you, then we can experience the fullness, the exhilaration that comes from a life in you. Thank you, Lord. We give you all the praise for that. In Jesus' name, amen. Questions or comments?